Hello and welcome to the Dot Ball Cricket Podcast. This is the podcast from South Africa dealing with South African cricket, both the Proteas and the domestic game. Very pleased to have John Kent, former Proteas all-rounder and Super Sport commentator with me. Hello, John. How are you doing? Fresh from a long stint in at St. George's Park for the CSA T20 Challenge.
All's good, Ken. Thanks very much. Yeah, good to have you see you guys again and be involved in your roundup. It's been an interesting time in PE. I think the competition went pretty well. A new winner, first time winner for the Rocks. So obviously very positive on that sense. And then, very pleased with how the Proteas have just fought back so well in their second test.
Yeah, let's start with the Proteas because that was, again, a quite remarkable series following on from the comeback win over India, getting absolutely slaughtered in the first test by the reigning World Test champions in Christchurch at the Hagley Oval, where New Zealand have an incredible record. They've won 8 of their last 10 tests, or 8 of the 10 tests played at the Hagley Oval. And then just another amazing comeback in the second test to win by 198 runs with a fantastic all-round performance. John, just looking at that first test, quite baffling, really, how a team which had just played so well against India, confidence should be high, goes and plays so badly. And I wanted to ask you, you've been to Australia, which is still a couple of hours west of New Zealand, so not quite as bad, but do you think jet lag may be a factor in that first test and obviously quarantine as well?
Yeah, I think they sort of gave us a slightly easier quarantining period. I think they try to help us out to help them out as well to get the games going. But I think the jet lag is the major problem we had in that first test. And I know I've chatted to a lot of people in the last couple of weeks now about the time it takes for you to get over that jet lag and perform in games, etc. So I did hear that, saying in that first test when it happened after our quarantine time is, we only should have really played a warm-up game in that sort of time frame. And we only would have been playing, should have played our first real competitive game when we've played the second test. So we've seen how we just weren't at the races in that first test. And I know, we're not going to pass judgment on performances there. I think that'd probably be really harsh on our great test team. But they showed once they spent some time there, they've got themselves acclimatized, so to speak. We've really given New Zealand a good hiding.
Yeah, I'm with you. Let's not talk about the first test anymore. There wasn't much to really discuss performance-wise. Credit to New Zealand. They were really, really good. But the Proteas were really quite terrible. We go to the second test, John, and I think what really struck me about that game was that the visiting side read the conditions so much better than the home team. I start with Dean Elgar at the toss. Extremely brave decision to bat first. And the fact also that they got their team selection spot on, choosing Keshav Maharaj.
Yeah, I think that wicket for the second test was a lot slower. It certainly wasn't as KG mentioned in his interviews. There was a lot more zip, a lot more pace, and a lot more movement in that first test. So, like a lot of times captains in test matches, they always think maybe have a bowl first and then rather have just stick to batting first, get first use of the wicket, which we did well. SJ brilliant, and then obviously Varane in the second innings, he showed what quality he has. And I think it's a lot of people sort of look at the conditions and they always think of bowling first, but if you don't take wickets in that first session as a bowling team, you really are sort of chasing the game after that. So at least we got a decent first inning score, which we haven't done for quite some time. And that obviously stood us in good stead for the rest of the game.
John, I mean, the Hagley Oval reminds me a little bit of Kingsmead back in your playing days, the Green Mamba. I'm sure that there were times when you had to go out and bat on a pretty green pitch at Kingsmead, but were you ever sent in by your own captain and the rest of the team was going, oh, hang on, shouldn't we be bowling?
Yeah, I think a lot of the time back in those days when they had the lawn was they said just we'll guts it out a little bit. We used to facing the ball, moving around quite a bit. Leave well, just be clever in how you go about it. And then we out bowl them as a bowling side. At that stage, we had like a Klusener, Tweedy, Nixon, McLean, those sort of guys. So we just said we're going to out bowl the opposition and make sure we bat well in the first innings. That I think that was the key. But just talking about obviously that first test, second test sort of difference, you saw a lot of guys leaving a lot better, especially like a guy like a Kyle Varane, where in domestic cricket and, you know, all the cricket he's played before this, he's sort of just not much foot movement and the hands just get through the ball, hit the ball through the offside. And I think this innings we haven't seen a lot of is him leaving a ball. So I think that's the sort of improvement and, you know, know-how from the player himself to change his game and adjust to conditions. And I'm just really pleased and proud of how quickly they learned their lessons from the first test, basically, and put it into effect straight away.
Indeed. It was interesting to hear Kyle Varane say after his wonderful 100 that footwork has never been a particularly big part of his game. He's not too fussed about it. Contact points are what he really concentrates on. But I think your point is still valid, because the point is that they were a lot more circumspect in terms of not playing outside off stump. They played a lot straighter, I thought. And especially a guy like Sorrell Avia, playing in just his second test match, opening the batting on that first morning, absolutely crucial time. And I thought he batted superbly well. He's obviously a guy from your neck of the woods, John, the KZN Dolphins. You've obviously seen a lot of him. You've obviously dealt with him a lot. I'm sure you weren't overly surprised that Avia did so well, considering that he's a very mature cricketer who's been through quite a lot in his career.
Yeah, I think you did on with that, with regarding like test cricket and what it takes to succeed at this level. And he's shown through all the levels that he's come through at KZN Inland for 5 seasons. Then he joined the Dolphins and dominated there in all the formats, as he's done throughout. He's a grounded person. And, you know, whether he's doing great or struggling, you wouldn't really know the difference. And I like that sort of level-headedness amongst some of the players. Obviously, sometimes some sort of performances go to guys' heads, and that's a little bit worrying. But obviously, the level-headedness is the key element. And I think even his 50-over cricket is maybe even his best format of the game. Over the years, he's been a really important part of that opening stand for the Dolphins in all sort of formats. So, yeah, he's reached that point where he knows his game and he understands it. And that's what you like to see. Obviously, some guys, the selectors take a punt on when they're really young and they don't quite, you know, match up to those high hopes. And sometimes they got to go back to domestic cricket and go and learn their game and hone their skills and come back better cricketers. I think that's not always a bad thing. I think obviously some guys get, you know, when they're a freak of nature, you know, those guys will get their opportunities. But you see the better players like a Cook or a Keegan Peterson and now SJ, Avia, that they sort of experienced players. And it's not really a surprise when they do well at this level now.
Yeah, absolutely. The value of having been through many challenges and I guess knowing how to adapt and knowing how to get out of poor runs of form, that sort of thing. There were some eyebrows raised as well that South Africa, after barely making 200 runs between their two innings in the first test, actually left out a batsman for the second test. It obviously worked out, and I think one of the really valuable things about the showing in the second test was we saw in the first innings that really crucial partnership between Marco Jansen and Keshav Maharaj. Kagiso Rabada with a sensational innings in the second innings, which really created time for South Africa because he scored so quickly. And I thought even Luto Sepamla actually looked vaguely decent with the bat at number 11 as well. So, John, just how vital was it that the lower order chipped in with some important runs as well?
Yeah, I think like Rabada getting runs if it's called confidence, it's amazing what package he can bring, taking all his wickets that he does, and then offering that sort of free-flowing stroke play. It's brilliant. I think Maharaj, he doesn't get in line with the ball at all, to be honest. But what he does is he backs away and he creates scoring opportunities. He's maybe not the bravest, but he plays his shots, and that's, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. And that's the best way for him to get runs. He's not tough it out and duck and get hit and etc. Not too many guys are keen on that sort of stuff. But, you know, if he can score some runs in a positive way, you know, all the better for our team. Yeah, it's very important that those guys contribute down the order if we have maybe a little middle order wobble from time to time. But, I think, in terms of selection, like you're saying, choosing one less batsman, it's just a case of sometimes teams select an extra batsman to cover some bases. But the truth is we need the top six score runs. I think that, like, we've got to face that sort of fact, I think, in all formats, the 2020s or the 50 over stuff. We can't be asking the number 8 and 9 to come in and hit the winning runs. You know, the top six have got to do the business.
Absolutely. And I guess we should add in there Vian Mulder, who on the fourth morning also played a really crucial hand with Kyle Varane in batting through the first hour, because if New Zealand had broke through then, it could have been a very different test match. And Keshav Maharaj, his problems against the short ball have been well documented, but I guess at least he's taking it on now. He's not just, trying to get away, out the way. He doesn't like the short ball. Not many people do. But at least he's taking it on and getting some runs in that area. John, you mentioned the Dolphins back in the day feeling that they could out-bowl teams in pace-friendly, seamer-friendly conditions. What did you think of the South African bowling? Kagiso Rabada, just wonderful to see him really leading the attack in such fine fashion.
Yeah, it's nothing better than watching that man in action. I think his pace also, I always look at the sort of pace the guys are bowling at also on, you know, at home conditions, away conditions, and see how they shaping up. I think, KG's always around the 140 mark, and when he wants to click, he can turn it up a bit more. I thought Sipamne in that sort of mid-120s, I was hoping he could get up into the sort of mid-130s, to be honest. And then obviously Mulder, sort of 125 around there, that sort of mark. But yeah, you never know how they're feeling. Maybe they might have a little niggle. But obviously, you know, getting the ball through at a fair rate always helps in test cricket. Otherwise, guys can just sort of wear you down. And I watched that wake up and smell the cricket a couple of mornings ago. Just wrapping up the cricket there, and they're saying, what is a Mulder? What is the Sipamne's job? Do they hold in domestic cricket? They're normally the strike bowlers, so they're quite attacking. But obviously in this format, we need sort of economy as well as the odd wicket from those guys. So I suppose it's just the role and how they use them. But I think Jansen is just going from strength to strength. In his role, obviously, I think a huge omission is obviously Anik Nokia. I think we really do miss him. But, yeah, obviously, we've done pretty well results-wise without him of late. But obviously, in Ngidi, I'm a little bit concerned with his fitness and obviously lack of cricket, etc. We need to see him back on the park and firing again.
Yeah, I thought Luta Sipamla and Vian Mulder did a really good job with the ball, just holding up their ends when required, nice and accurate, especially in that second innings. And, of course, Luto Sipamla getting the crucial wicket of Devon Conway, LBW, with a fantastic Yorker when he had 92. But I agree, wouldn't it be wonderful if Sipamla, who I think had his best in that game, touched sort of 130 k's an hour, if he could regularly get into the mid-130s, with the accuracy he showed and the skill, he could really be a world-class bowler. We need to mention Marco Jansen, another 7 wickets in this test match. So he's now taken 28 wickets in his first 5 test matches. So what a wonderful start to his test career he's had.
Let's move on now to the statistical highlights of this remarkable series in New Zealand. And as ever, we have Andrew Sampson our statistical guru, with all those details for us.
Yes, a disappointing start to the series in New Zealand for South Africa. A proper thrashing by an innings and 276 runs, which is the 12th biggest victory margin by an innings all time in Test cricket. And South Africa have only ever suffered one worse loss, and that was in the Test match at the Wanderers in 2002, where they lost by an innings and 360 runs to Australia. People will remember Adam Gilchrist making a double hundred in that game. And in that first Test, South Africa had two new debutants. Well, all debutants are new, but two debutants, Sorrel Evia and Clinton Stuerman, who both obviously deserved the opportunity to come up. Evia going on to score 100 in the second Test. But Evia's 32 years old and Stuerman's 29. And it's been a continuation of what I think is a little bit of a worrying trend. And we're now of the last 11 debutants in Test cricket for South Africa, going back to the Boxing Day Test against England in 2019. Five of those 11 over the age of 30, and two more over the age of 29. You kind of got to wonder if there aren't a few younger options available who may be a better long-term prospect than some of those that have been chosen by South Africa. But in the second Test, a tremendous comeback for South Africa, winning the Test easily by 198 runs, which was a massive turnaround, obviously. So one of the things that you look for in a kind of turnaround like that is how do you quantify that turnaround? And basically, of the teams that have lost a Test match by an innings and 200 runs, or 200 or more runs, there are 53 of those teams, and only 10 of them went on to win the next Test. The most impressive turnaround, purely statistically, is Australia in 1938. The biggest loss in the history of Test cricket. England made 903 for 7 at the Oval. Len Hutton famously making 364, at the time the highest Test score. And they went on to beat Australia by an innings and 579, with Australia having both Don Bradman and Jack Fingleton not batting in either innings due to injuries that they picked up, not terribly surprisingly, fielding at a total of 903 for 7. Their next Test match, they won by an innings and 103 runs. That was against New Zealand in Sri Lanka. It was against New Zealand in Wellington in 1946, which, of course, is nearly 8 years later. So it probably doesn't really count as a turnaround. So what you're looking for is not so much what a team did in its next Test, having been thrashed by an innings and 200 runs, but what they did. But if they did that in the same series. And it's only the fourth time that a team has won a Test match in the next Test match in the same series, having lost by an innings and 200 runs in the previous Test match. In 1998, Australia did it in India, losing by 219 innings and 219 runs in Calcutta, and then winning the next Test by 8 wickets. India then did it to Sri Lanka in 2008, losing by an innings and 239 runs, and winning the next one by 170 runs. And the most recent one was in England in 2017, when the West Indies got beaten in a day-night Test at Birmingham by an innings and 209 runs, and then went on to a famous victory in the following Test at Leeds, chasing 322 to win by 5 wickets. So South Africa joins that little list of four teams. And, of course, the 276-run margin is higher than any of the other three series that I mentioned there. So a really extraordinary turnaround. And of course, a one-all series result in two Tests leaves a lot of people, including me, of course, asking why there isn't a third Test. And sadly, the reality is most Test series these days are two Tests, which is quite frankly ridiculous. But the last time there was a three-Test series not involving any of the big three, England, Australia, or India, was 2019. It's 3 years ago, when Pakistan were in South Africa. And I think it's wishful thinking, unfortunately, that we're going to see any more three-Test series not involving any of the big three.
Thanks very much, Andrew. Fascinating stuff as ever.
And just to echo, John, what you said about we've got the Bangladesh series coming up in a bit less than a month's time. And to the South African team, obviously, we have to add Keegan Peterson on the batting side. But I'm very excited that if Unrick Nokia and Lungi Ngidi are fit, that really gives you a hell of an attack. Rabada Jansen, Ngidi, Nokia, Maharaj. That's something to look forward to, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that the IPL might be involved somewhere along the way, whether, you know, our guys missed a test or guys missed one test, but you're looking at Anokia, Rabada, Ngidi, Janssen, obviously Van der Dussen, Markram. You know, we're missing big numbers in that test team if they do go and when they go, because they're likely to leave at some point. So we just need to sort of, I guess, follow that progress from CSA to see how many games these guys are going to play. But yeah, obviously they're important, and what we might see is a even more new faces, possibly for the second test, which is around sort of the 10th of April, around that sort of period. And obviously the IPL starts. So yeah, we're just going to have to follow that progress and see where CSA leads us.
Yeah, the last I heard on that, and certainly Dean Elgar's expectation, is that everyone needs to be available until the end of the series. Whether that does actually happen, of course, is another matter. But I don't think we should underestimate this series against Bangladesh. We're playing at the two coastal venues, Kingsmead and St. George's Park. It's the exact same itinerary as when Sri Lanka shocked South Africa a few years back, winning 2-0. Coastal conditions the most favourable for subcontinental teams in the country. And Bangladesh beat New Zealand in the first test in New Zealand not that long ago. So I really hope that we're not going to underestimate them. And, of course, 2-0 should be the aim to get valuable World Test Championship points.
Yeah, we have to try and take them down and whitewash them here. But I think the Port Elizabeth Dubeka groundsman, Adrian Carter, did an amazing job in that T20 series, I thought. Obviously, towards the end, I'd obviously started getting a bit more tired. But he's got obviously four momentum games, or I should say one-day cup games. And obviously then there's the test match. So he's going to have to really try and manage that well and, you know, keep plenty of grass on the wicket here and try to get a bit of pace in it. Durban, you know, I've been a little bit worried for the Durban Kingsmead pitch for quite some time now. There's just no pace in it. You know, nothing in for the seamers, really slow. Yeah, so that's a bit of a concern. And hopefully Wilson Gobezi can sort that out at Kingsmead to make sure there's pace, there's bounce, there's grass on the wicket to suit our style of play.
Absolutely, yeah. I'm glad you mentioned the St. George's Park pitch, and because I think it's a good time to go across to the CSA T20 Challenge now. When St. George's Park was announced as the venue for the entire T20 competition, I was a bit concerned because the pitch so far in the summer had actually been not that good for batting. And you don't really want to have a T20 competition where the ball dominates the bat to a great extent. But I think the pitches were fantastic. I thought there was a nice range of conditions. The spinners came into it a lot. But there was enough there for the seamers, and there were some very good batting displays as well. John Kent, you were an integral part of the excellent SuperSport coverage of that entire tournament in Gqeberha, Port Elizabeth. What were the main takeaways, the main highlights of the CSA T20 Challenge for you?
I'd say it was obviously the emergence of some players that had formerly been sort of boxed in certain formats. The Peter Malan obviously being the standout top run scorer, captain of the Rocks. You know, they, after two games, they were bottom of the table, and they had a super over which they managed to just beat the Northwest Dragons. And for after that, they really sort of started finding some form. Their spinners were excellent. Obviously, other highlights would be like the Stubbs from Warriors, who, you know, surely it must be in the picture, you know, for Victor Mpitsang to start considering for the national side. His strike rate was over 200. You know, he was sort of playing on a different level for this tournament, to be honest. The likes of Miller showed some moments of brilliance. And as well, Shamsi towards the end of the tournament, he really stepped up. But some of the teams were a little bit exposed. For example, like the Warriors bowling attack really got picked off. Their batting side is really impressive. They played a really good brand of cricket throughout, and they were at the forefront of it. And the Lions had a difficult campaign. A couple of slightly inexperienced guys in that middle order, with the loss of some of their national players, obviously counted against them. But the Titans looked really sort of poised to win the tournament. In the early stages, they really started finding some form. But yeah, obviously, yeah, they just fell at the last hurdle there, to be honest.
Yeah, I'm pleased to say that in my previews of the tournament, I did pick the Boland Rocks as one of the teams to watch, mostly because their bowling attack, I think, just covers so many bases. Obviously, Peter Malan had a wonderful tournament up front, and I think when you do get slightly lower scoring T20 games, that sort of batsman is invaluable. But if you look at their attack, I mean, they had a Hardis Viljoen able to take wickets when required, when they really, really needed wickets. Farisco Adams, so good at the death, so skillful, and then wonderful spinners. Siyabonga Mahima, Imran Manak, Sean van Berg just had a wonderful tournament as well. So I wasn't overly surprised to see them doing so well.
Yeah, they really put it together. They had a real good, like, sort of team vibe going on. I think a lot of the teams in this competition were struggling to find the right combinations, I think, at times. Obviously, the Dolphins had Pekla Kwayo to bat at three. Imran Khan obviously tried that out. It didn't really work. And then they obviously went back to him at sort of 6-7, and then they tried it a swat up in the top order, which didn't work either. So they were a little bit – so never really settled on a lineup they could back. And that sort of cost them in the end. Obviously, the Knights also had a poor series. Their lineup wasn't quite suited, as you say, to those conditions in terms of spinners. You know, they had some left-arm orthodox spinner, Makhlo Kwana, which they didn't really bowl much. And then they just had some part-time spinners otherwise. So I think that's where they struggled. I think that most of the sides who really got through, obviously, to that final had the best balance sides in the competition, which is how it should work.
Yeah, John, you mentioned Tristan Stubbs. Every once in a while a guy will just be a real shooting star at domestic level, really capture the public's imagination. He batted really well, I think, the end of last season, batted really well in the T20 knockout at the start of this summer. But his form in this recent tournament was just incredible. And by no means am I suggesting that David Miller should be phased out of the Proteas team. He's only 32, so there's still a lot of time left for David Miller to contribute to the Proteas. But I would like to see Stubbs brought into the Proteas team almost as an understudy to David Miller, as his kind of to groom Stubbs that one day he could take over from David Miller and be as effective as Miller has been, and even maybe look at a guy like Donovan Ferreira as well.
Yeah, Donovan Ferreira, I missed out him earlier, and he's also really, you know, for a guy who's not even contracted, he's shown a few guys up who are contracted around the country to what he's capable of. Obviously, Stubbs and him are probably the highest strike rates in the whole tournament, along with Miller. But yeah, I don't know, like, talk about Stubbs as an understudy, you know, to Miller. You know, Stubbs is the main guy putting pressure on Miller and the Van der Dussens and the Markrams, and this is what we need. You know, look at guys now. You talk about even going back to the Test cricket quickly now with Kieran Peterson coming back. You know, where is Markram going to fit in? There's Van der Dussen, Bavuma, Verena. You know, so one of those guys is going to miss out. Would it be Van der Dussen or Markram? You know, those sort of decisions are coming, and I think some of the players actually know that. So it's going to be tricky times, I think, in terms of even the Test batting lineup now. Maybe the RPL might put that to bed, but yeah, there's good pressure coming onto the guys at the top.
Quite right, and I think it is going to be either Aidan Markram or Rassie van der Dussen who is going to have to make way for Keegan Peterson in the Test side. Just wrapping up what is coming ahead, we mentioned the Bangladesh series that the Proteas will be involved in. Three ODIs, followed by two test matches. The ODIs starting on the 18th of March at Centurion. They then go to the Wanderers on 2 days later, the 20th of March, and then ending that series at Centurion Wednesday, 23rd of March. And then the two tests, March 30th to April 3rd. I actually think it's March 30th, 31st to April 4th. Crick Info's dates are wrong, as far as I know, at Kingsmead, and then April 8th to 12th in Port Elizabeth. We do have some big domestic cricket coming up in the coming days, and that's the final game of the four-day franchise series, and it's coming to a very exciting conclusion because the Central Gauteng Lions are currently top of the log on 111.3 points. But at one stage of the season, they were absolutely running away with the competition. But two sides have caught up, and that is the Eastern Province Warriors on 110.82, so they're 0.48 points behind only, and the Northern Titans on 105 points. And in the final round of fixtures, it's going to be the Northern Titans hosting the Central Gauteng Lions at SuperSport Park. So obviously, if the Northern Titans win that game, they will overtake the Lions. And then we have to look at what the Warriors do. And they're travelling to Bloemfontein to play against the Free State Knights. So, John Kent, where's your money for the end of the four-day franchise series? Who are we going to see emerge as champions?
Sure, it's a tough one. I'll probably back the Titans right now. You've got to say, though, that the Warriors, you know, they've done a really great job. You know, their four-day cricket, they were, you know, bottom of the, when there were six teams, and they were struggling at times. But they really have made a wonderful effort under Robin Peterson. I think Rudy Second sort of takes over that team. But really a great effort for them to really be in the running towards the end. Lions consistent, the Titans consistent again. I think the Titans squad, you know, if you look at some players maybe unavailable now with a national team, etc. The Titans probably look like they've got the side to do the job, I think.
Yeah, I do know that the Lions are trying very hard to get some of their Proteas players back. Understandably, they might have to deal with jet lag again. And I believe the Titans are hoping to be able to field Simon Harmer, obviously the champion off spinner, who was in Port Elizabeth, in New Zealand at least. And kudos to Robin Peterson, certainly doing a great job with the Warriors. So that's all we have for you on this show this week. We'll be back shortly, I imagine, with a wrap-up of that four-day franchise series, just how that all ended. And also, we'll preview the Bangladesh series once we're a bit closer to that. John Kent, thanks so much for your time. Go well, and thank you, listeners. And don't forget to subscribe and like us. And if you want to communicate with us, you can as well. We are on Twitter at @dotballpodcast, or one word. Thanks very much for your time. We'll speak again soon.